Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
My new podcast, Crimes Of, explores the forces behind some of the most unforgettable crimes in history. Listen to and follow Crimes Of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders about their experiences, their insights, and their aspirations. I'm Henry Lake with WCCO Radio. Today's CEO, Glenn Gunderson, gets to know Tanya Allen, president of the McKnight Foundation, a Minnesota-based family foundation seeking to create a more abundant future where people and planet thrive. Find out what it's like for Allen to lead an all-woman, majority people of color senior leadership team.
Hey, Tanya Allen, welcome to the podcast. I'm so grateful to have you here. You are a leader for good, and I'm excited for our conversation. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Glenn. I'm so excited, and I feel very privileged to be here. So thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, I do want to talk about you leading McKnight eventually, but I want to start first with maybe your childhood and where you've come from. And I know, digging into your background a little bit, there was an influential grandmama out there. Share some stories.
Right. Well, it seems like if we're lucky enough to have a grandmother in our lives, they tend to have a great influence on us. And that was exactly my experience. I often describe my grandmother, when people see me, I'm about 5'10". My grandmother was actually 4'10". And part of the reason I love to tell this story about how small she was, not to suggest that she was diminutive, but really to suggest like how bold and powerful she was, regardless of her stature. And so my grandmother was an evangelist. And as you can imagine, in her day and age, being a woman preacher was pretty rare and very frowned upon. And so when I was a kid, she would, because evangelists go church to church, she would pack us up on Sunday morning and we'd land at wherever what she would say the Spirit called her. And what was so powerful about me thinking about her legacy on me was that we would be in the back of the church. And if the Spirit called her, she would walk to the front of the church and start preaching, regardless if they invited her or not. And so that boldness and that courage, I think, was really instilled in me as a young woman or a young child. And so just seeing her, hearing her, and then also seeing her as a neighborhood organizer. So in her life, she spent a lot of time thinking about how you make community, how you build community, how you support each other. And there just were so many memorable lessons I had of her, which includes opening up her home in the middle of the night and bringing an entire family in because it was winter and they didn't have heat. She found out about it and walked over in the middle of the night, knocked on their doors, got them up, brought them into her home. And those were the kind of images that were cemented in my mind when I think of her, but also when I think of community.
What other inflection points showed up early for you in terms of kind of forming you as a leader?
Oh, that's a great question. I think what I would say is I felt like a natural proclivity to just kind of like gather people together to try and solve problems and figure out problems. And some people called it a little bit being bossy, but I just called it a proclivity, right? My cousins called it bossy, but it was just kind of like, let's get together. Let's figure it out. Like, we can solve this. And one of the things my grandmother always said was like, none of us is as smart as all of us. And so that was always my attempt to try and create an environment where we could solve problems together. And then I think the other thing that kind of resonated for me was that I think as a young person, and I think today, like I tend to be insightful. Like I can listen to those things that aren't said and kind of hear vibrations, even if you never speak the words, and try and leaning into that skill, right? And navigating that skill to help people understand and to speak life into the words and the feelings that they're having that actually enables and equips them to be able to figure out like, oh, if you understand me, you feel me, then now we can move to the next step, which is how do we solve the problem? And many times people just want to be seen and people want to be heard for their humanity and for their reality. And I try my best to listen for that and to understand it because it's so insightful to, it's so informative is probably the best, better word. So informative to me as a leader and as a person and as a human, just really trying to think through what does it mean? What are these experiences? And how do we take people in their wholeness, not just and their aspirations and their contributions, and not just focus on humans based on their deficits, which is kind of like what we tend to do, particularly in the nonprofit sector.
Yeah. Well, I love your kind of grasp on humanity and kind of everything that we as humans bring to work or to our homes or what have you. So important. And I love also your description of proclivity for leadership versus being bossy. I can appreciate that too. I was told I was bossy as a five-year-old as well. So when you go, when you think back to your childhood, what was it like beyond this indomitable spirit of a grandmother? What was childhood like for you?
My childhood was full of family. So my grandmother had 10 children. And so you can imagine there were lots of cousins and her house was a hub for us. So it was a place where we gathered together and you learned how to negotiate relationships. And then I also had a really stable home. My mother, as a leader, as a parent, was very stable, who helped me think through a lot of different things and to interpret how you address and, you know, address challenges, how you show up with opportunities. So even though as a human being, she was stable, our economics were not. And so as a result, it was, we moved a lot. So I probably moved as a kid. I think I went to maybe about almost 10, I think it made the last count, it was like 9 or 10 schools during my kind of K-8 experience. So you can imagine moving so much, you end up learning how to adapt to new environments. And I also feel like it taught me how to not be afraid of change, that I don't feel discomforted by change. It actually feels more natural to me. And I also know that I'm capable in that environment because you got tested every time you went and did something else. You build a level of resiliency around change. And so I think those experiences were crucial of like having stability around who I am as a person and feeling completely embraced and loved and cherished. And at the same time, also navigating dynamics that you couldn't control that would have an influence on you. So how do you show up when you're trying to navigate that dynamism that happens in your life?
Yeah, so important. And I think about our young people today that resilience is so important, what they're enduring and living through. As sticking with your, you know, being a young person and as you're growing up, how did race show up in your life? How did it show up in your community?
Oh, it's a great question. Well, one, you can see I have very fair skin, right? And what's so funny about that is it took me until I was an adult to actually understand how fair my skin is. And the reason why is because, you know, I grew up in Detroit, and Detroit is predominantly a Black city. Although in different parts of the city, it's a very diverse place. And so growing up in a Black family, my identity was very solid, regardless of how fair my skin was. So that was cemented for me. But I would say, like, I wrestled with it early. I remember as a child, I was with my friends who were white and Polish, who they called me a white nigger. And so in that moment, I had to figure out like what that meant. But all I knew deep inside was like, these people that I loved were cutting me very deeply in a way that I didn't understand. Even as a little kid, because I was like maybe about 5 or 6, I could feel the trauma behind the word, even though I didn't know the history behind the word. And so I remember like revisiting that pain quite a bit as a kid, trying to think like, what did that mean? Why did they say that? What did it? So, so I think wrestling with that taught me pretty early to wrestle with these kind of challenges early. And then as a college student, I started to learn really about my privilege that I have by having lighter skin. Like that there are certain things, like I think I'm smart, I think I'm cute, but all of those things, I am those things. But I also know that my fair skin has given me privileges and passes that other people who are just as smart or just as cute as I am may not have had. And so wrestling with that and understanding, like, how do I use that skin privilege, even though my identity is Black? How do I use that skin privilege to help people navigate a tough issue like race? So that's how I kind of think about race and wrestling with it.
Yeah, I appreciate that candor, you know, and bringing that some of those painful things back up again, and really grateful for your transparency there. And those are places where we all can learn and become better stewards and better equity leaders. So grateful for that. So you mentioned college. So you go off to Michigan and both for undergraduate and graduate, right? And
I did.
What was your college experience like? And what did you what started to form in you from a leadership perspective?
Yeah. So when I was in college, I probably majored in leadership, student leadership and student activism more than I did in the classroom at hand. So I started off, I felt like I was very activated even going into college. I had started to really, just like most young people, kind of understand like where your strengths are, where your interests are, where your passions are. And so when I went to the University of Michigan, I leaned into that quite a bit, trying to figure out like what my leadership voice is, what my leadership capacity is. How you use your voice for good, how you show up, how to be reliable, which are all kinds of things that I had to work on, right? As a young person is trying to figure out like how to be reliable. And I often use the word reliability because I think that lots of people underestimate that, meaning like people should be able to know who you are anytime in any place, because you show up consistently and reliably. And that is a fundamental attribute of trust, right? And so I learned how to show up in a reliable way through college. But I probably served on or led every organization that would let me. So I served as an organizer around, kind of campus safety, campus fights with staff and students, which we would now describe as like over-policing of Black people, right? Like mm-hmm. That's essentially what was having kids having the fun, having parties, nothing going on. The next thing you know, people are being maced. I served as the kind of what we described as the president, or we called it the speaker of the Black Student Union, which I got to work with other leaders across universities to work on issues that Black students were facing all through the state of Michigan. And then also, you may know this, but in the Black community, particularly college educated community, sororities and fraternities are really important. And so I served as the kind of leader of the Black Greek Association. Mm-hmm. So I had all these interesting ways of showing up, which were all about how do we create community, how do we protect community, and how do we advance community?
Yeah, it's interesting. You took all 4'10" of your grandma and added a foot and just got after it as an evangelist in your own right in college. How cool.
That's a good way to talk about it. Thank you.
Yeah, interesting. It didn't take long for you to put your fingerprints onto that campus. So very cool. And then started working in foundations. Maybe you want to share a little bit about some of your leadership experiences early and touch on your work at Skillman.
Oh, sure. So when I left college, I started to do community organizing work, and I was working to organize churches, organize parents, organize neighborhoods, focusing on school reform, community building. And what I learned as an organizer was one of my favorite mantras: power is organized people or organized money. And so when I started to wrestle with that concept, I felt like, you know what, there's plenty of people who are working to organize people, but how are we working to organize money? So really trying to think about how money and power could actually create the change you would want to have. Because as a young person, I used to struggle with the word power, because to me, back then, power corrupted, right? And so I had to reclaim what power meant. And, you know, I think about, you know, power is the ability to enact love, right? And so how do you show up and love communities? And so I started to really think through that question, and philanthropy was the place that I started. So I wanted to kind of understand how people were organizing money in the philanthropic sector. And more importantly, after I learned how you did in the philanthropic sector, you quickly then learned that philanthropy is very small in considering the scope of our economy, our world, how things change happen. So it became an imperative to me was, now how do you use the perch of philanthropy to organize money in corporations, from government, from other private actors, so that you could do a collective good in a more powerful and sustainable and enduring way. So that's how I kind of came at this question of philanthropy and how it evolved. And it still is kind of the same for me today. I'm always trying to think about, like, how do we move people who have power to behave in the interest of the common good, which is also usually in their interest too. But you have to help sometimes make everybody see that leap in that connection and the interwovenness of our realities and our destiny, et cetera. Yeah. So my work at Skillman came after doing work in neighborhoods with communities, organizing people, working on tough systems issues. And so when I was at the Skillman Foundation, I started there working on how do you build or create an enabling environment for children, which is the work that you do, right? Like in places and in communities, how do you create just a rich environment that actually allows children to thrive, that they could get what they needed in community, and that there were enough caring adults around them that would actually allow them to thrive and achieve their aspirations despite the challenges that were in their way. And it was really this ambition of not just helping kids beat the odds, but how do we change the odds, right? Like, that's really the question. How do we change odds so every child can thrive? And that was the bulk of my work, or the kind of ambition I had and the passion I had at the Skillman Foundation was, like, we can change systems, we can change practices, we can reorganize ourselves and rewrite the rules. And if we rewrite the rules, which is my other definition of power, then we actually create the change that we believe, you know, benefits all of us, not just some of us.
Yeah, man, I love that, you know, moving from beat the odds to changing the odds. What a simple but very elegant and important consideration. And then I really like how you articulate, you know, the success around leadership and what it's really, you know, what we're really after in terms of changing the game for everyone we're serving. So, hey, I'm talking to Tanya Allen, McKnight Foundation. You become the CEO of McKnight Foundation, and you called it a divine interruption. I love that term. So what were you thinking going from Skillman in Detroit and accepting this big challenge at McKnight in Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Yeah, so I called my move from the Skillman Foundation in Detroit to the McKnight Foundation in Minneapolis a divine interruption for this reason. I was leading extraordinarily meaningful work in Detroit. Like I lived a meaningful life, where I felt like I was stretching myself, having the kind of influence, having things under my belt that I felt very proud of, like accomplishments that I, along with lots of other people in community, were creating.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Hey there, we're Corinne Vien and Sabrina Deanna Roga here to introduce our newest podcast, Crimes of, a Crime House original.
Crimes of is a weekly series that explores a new theme each season, from crimes of the paranormal, unsolved murders, and more. Our first season is Crimes of Infamy, the true crime stories behind Hollywood's most iconic horror villains.
Listen to and follow Crimes of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Radio Rental. The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life. All told by real people. And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. There's something here in this house. Something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But in that moment, you know, I, like everybody else in the country, I was struck by the power of this place. And let me say that, because a lot of times when we talk about Minneapolis or we talk about the Twin Cities, and particularly when we talk about George Floyd's death, we talk about how terrible this place is, how bad the disparities are that such a tragedy could occur. But I also think what we miss is talking about how the people came out of their homes in a deep moment of fear during the pandemic. And they decided to show up and recreate community. And then to fight what they thought was wrong and to show up every day. You know, after 120 days in protest that sparked the racial reckoning across this country and in some cases across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, think about this being that global epicenter of change and, you know, seeing right. A mural of George Floyd in Amsterdam or some other part of the world. It really is amazing to think. And I love how you're espousing this hope notion that we can look at the deficits, but as you mentioned earlier, or we can look at the assets, the positives. Right. And I'm a child of this community, been here my whole life, and I do see this rich strength and vitality that can arise. I'm curious, though, there's a big contrast between Detroit, a community, yeah, like you said, that has a strong Black population, a strong Black middle class, much, much larger population of color. And you come here and it might look a little different, where some of our poverty is concentrated. Maybe we've got not as strong or deep a Black middle class, or some of those dynamics that we really need to invest in. How do you compare those two cities?
I'm going to compare them in one sec, but let me just finish this other thought.
Yeah, pardon me. Yeah, please.
So the interruption was, if I saw young people show up every day, whether it was cold, whether it was hot, whether it was raining or not, right? And I don't know about you, but if you've ever been on your knees in the middle of a protest, right, when you're doing it for the same amount of time that knee was on George Floyd's neck, then you understand that they were not comfortable.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, is what drove me to even think about leaving Detroit, is that this was not about my personal comfort. It was about, what's my personal contribution and where best could I contribute it? And there is no better place in my mind than Minneapolis, because I believe that Minneapolis and the Twin Cities, we may be known as the epicenter of racial injustice because of George Floyd. I believe that we will become known the epicenter of racial opportunity because of the work that the people here will do to make sure that this place will be the place that George Floyd could have lived and thrived, right? So that was the rationale about this kind of divine interruption of moving me. Before, I was not necessarily ready to be moved, but I'm glad that I was. And to your point about going from that city to this city. So one of the great privileges about being a child of Detroit is that if you wanted to look for Black excellence, regardless of the challenges of the city, right? Because sometimes people conflate what the city is with the people. And that's not always true, right? But in Detroit, you never had to look for Black excellence. Like, you had lawyers and doctors and architects, and you saw people do amazing things, even though we had deep challenges and disparities and greater poverty in that city than in most cities, right? And it wasn't, to your point, concentrated in one place. It was spread across the city because the city's population or infrastructure was built for almost 2 million people, and we had close to 700,000. So you see that, like, you understand the structural and the system things around that, but it also gives you a confidence, right? Like, I can do anything. That's why you see stuff like Detroit versus everybody on t-shirts, because we didn't expect anybody to come save us. Like, we knew that if we were going to turn this city around, that we had to show up in our greatness around that work. And so I would say, when I contrast that to what I see in the Twin Cities, is I see extraordinarily talented people, like, so much talent. I see a ton of wealth, and I see a ton of passion. But I also see a place that sometimes likes the incremental more than the scaled and strategic impact of projects that we could probably do together. And I also see a humility that actually sometimes prevents us from reaching as far as we can. And I often talk about money, because I feel like we in this region have enough money to go it alone. In a place like Detroit, you never had enough money to go it alone, so you had to always go together. And so I think if we can move beyond having the choice to go it alone and actually making a decision to do it together, then we have more ability to have greater impact than most places across the country. So I want to lean into that. Like, I want to lean into all of these smart people who are committed to make a difference and who have the resources and who have the ability to make decisions. It's for us to make those decisions and do it together. And I think if we can do that in an effective way, and in a trusting way, that we can actually show that our values can be executed in public policy and how we show up and how we appreciate people and their contributions, their aspirations, their humanity, while we're trying to figure out how to deal with those deficits that are preventing them from being their full selves and potential.
Yeah. Well, I really love that notion, this going alone versus going together. And it is true. I mean, I think in our community, having grown up here, I see this sense of living in a bubble and not really having to engage maybe with folks that look different than me or that a different circumstance versus really going it together. So I think it's a great challenge for us as a community. Speaking of challenges, I think you're raising the expectations for us in your role at McKnight as a community. And I know you've got the Groundbreak Initiative and some big dreams. Would you just share a little bit about those dreams?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to. So I'm very excited about this work that we're doing, which we call the Groundbreak Coalition. So let me just say this. So when you have an event like George Floyd's murder, what ends up happening is that we all of a sudden become extraordinarily urgent. We are urgent for action. And I am always urgent. Everybody knows me. I'm urgent. The challenge with being urgent for action is that you don't focus on the things that actually will create transformative, durable change, right? So we have to figure out how to address this paradox of like going fast and going slow. And so that's what I think the Groundbreak Coalition is attempting to do, is how do we move quickly to show that our behavior will match our values that we espouse? And at the same time, how do we create fundamental change in our institutions so that that change we're trying to do, or the change that we will do, isn't temporary and it can't be diverted, or you don't get the pullback or the retraction that you usually see after there's any racial progress. That's what our country is known for. You make some racial progress and you got about 6 to 7 years before you see that retraction. Time moves faster these days, so I think it's even shorter here. But not in our country, but not necessarily shorter in Minneapolis. I think we have to lean into our pain so that we can find our purpose. And so what I would say about Groundbreak is a simple concept, is that we as a community know our problems. Actually, we're very good at studying them and putting reports out on them, right? And there are lots of them. We've talked to community. They told us time and time again what they need from us. But what we haven't done is actually deliver it. And Groundbreak is really about trying to deliver it, not delivering ideas, but how do you deliver the capital that actually makes it possible? I'll give you one quick example and then I'll go a little deeper into Groundbreak. So when I first got here, after the uprisings, I asked someone, what can I do to be helpful? And this person, very wise and thoughtful, said to me, you know, we're going to repair, we're going to rebuild, and we need to reimagine. We have folks who are working on the repair and rebuild, but we need somebody to work on the reimagine. So our team goes to work doing that. And as I get the first report back, then it dawns on me, what we're doing is setting up community. This is what we always do. We tell them to go out and dream, tell us what they want. Tell us what they want us to do, yet we never execute it because we've never figured out how do you get the money and the capital to actually implement those ideas. So Groundbreak is really about that, simply that if we actually want to change the trajectory of our community and keep our promises to people that we said, we're going to see racism and we're going to see bias and we're going to actually get it out of our systems and our practices. And we're going to create an equitable Twin Cities, an equitable Minnesota. So this is really about finding the people who have capital, who deploy them, the financial institutions, the corporations, the foundations, government and jurisdictional bodies, as well as investors and sometimes individuals who have capital. And if you want to move these things that our community said, which are really simple, home ownership, affordable housing, BIPOC entrepreneurship, and investing in the culture corridors that were affected by the uprising. If we can organize our capital in a different way, right? So yes, there are some things that work, some capital products that work. So let's enable those. Let's remove barriers to those. And then there are some capital products that don't work. So how do we create new capital products? Because we have power. We are the people who rewrite the rules. So let's rewrite rules. And so the teams of people across our great community are working together to figure out, like, how do we solve this? What do the financial tools look like? What's the unique role of financial institutions in that? What's the unique role of philanthropy, the unique role of government? If people can come together, figure that out, figure out the tools, and that they're naming the things they will invest in, not naming the things that they hope somebody else will invest in, then we create a platform for us to move money in an equitable way, and also for us to attract money from a national perspective to be able to invest in Minneapolis and in the Twin Cities more broadly, the region. We actually should be pulling in even more resources across the country from federal investment, from investors nationally and globally who have a stake in our success, because they believe, even without them knowing that we are going to go through this transformation, they believe in that. They want to believe in that. So we have to give them a platform for their investment, for our investment, and for us to go it together, which we've been talking about, throughout this interview is, you know, how do we, here's another one of my grandmother's sayings, let's go as far as we can see, and then we'll see how far we can go. Like, let's go, let's move together. And then, yes, there are going to be challenges, but in that way, that's the only way you're going to figure out how far you can actually go and what you can achieve.
I'm curious. I love, by the way, that, you know, transformational perspective and the durable change perspective. And thank you for that vision. And very excited for Groundbreak and your leadership in our community. You are just doing such game changing thinking and work, and we're grateful. How do you think about organizations like the Y and me as a leader, middle-aged white dude? You know, what are you looking for from leaders like me, from organizations like the Y?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And it's a great question because I don't think it's just about you or just about the Y, right? It's about all of us. Like, what's the hard work we're doing? You know, I often say, like, sometimes people look at people of color or Black people and say, like, what do we do to be more equitable? Or how do we stamp out racism? And I often say, like, if we had the answers, we would have been told you. I'm not sure you would have listened, but but the point I'm making is, like, we have grown up in a world, if we're American, that actually has centered whiteness, centered privilege. And so we all are in that construct. So we all have to actively fight outside of that construct if we're going to be effective. So what I would say for Glenn, for you, is like, how do you lead with humility and create host, you know, I'd like to describe it as host leadership. How do you host other people into leadership that helps you understand different perspectives, different lived experiences that question and challenge you to approach something completely different just because their purview and their perspective is so different? I always feel when I'm challenged that way, I'm a better person, a better leader, a more empathetic person. When you think about Myers-Briggs, I'm so far on the T side, like, you know, thinking side, is very hard for me to sometimes focus on the F side without actually being intentional about it. And that it grows me as a human being. And then I think as a better leader. And then I think the Y is already doing amazing things, right? Like you are creating platforms for leaders to come together. You know, I think about your work on the over north, where you are, you know, serving as the kind of backbone and a fiduciary agent for so many community groups, and how they're thinking about that. Like, continue to flex that muscle, right? So that it's about how the why shows up with purpose. And that purpose, being purpose driven as an organization, isn't about like how you make sure the why thrives, even though that is a part of the equation. It's really how does the why show up trying to achieve its mission that is beyond itself as an organization. And I think if the why can do that in all of us, in our organizations and institutions, to move beyond our own individual mission to focus on what the purpose and the impact that we're trying to create, and restructure ourselves in a way that allows us to be able to execute on that, then I think we make the impact. We are the impact, right? We set the tone, we change the culture. And I think sometimes we think we can't do those things because it feels so overwhelming. But I would just say it's quite possible. We always do this, and this is, and we're more than capable. And so I'm just lean into power, lean into your power. Even, you know, I think sometimes it's hard as a white man these days, where it's almost like you don't want white men to have power. No, I actually want white men to have power. I just want you to deploy it for love, not deploy it for gain, right? Like not to preserve what you've had, not to protect and be in defense, or to fix problems that have been broken. But how do we build, right? Like use your power to build a society where you have equity, and that people's voices count and people's experiences count, and that you create opportunities that are abundant and plentiful for all of us to show up as our best selves.
Yeah, I do love your challenge around love. We've been spending a lot of time internally with the why, trying to develop this notion of loving and developing our team members, but then also thinking about loving and serving our community. And so a great challenge from you. All right, last question.
Well, can I say one thing about love?
Oh yeah, no, please. Yes, please.
So here's the thing about love. I work in the field of philanthropy, and so do you, right? My field of philanthropy is we give away resources. Your field of philanthropy is you provide direct services to people in our community. Mm-hmm. Well, the word philanthropy is defined as the love of people. Right. So when we stop doing this work because we're focusing on issues, and we start to define people by their issues, their problems and their challenges, and not define people by who they are. Right. Like we actually I actually think that that's a flaw of our industry, is that we've taken love out of who we're, what we're doing, why we're doing it. And I don't say love as like this, like soft word where I'm mushy. I say love like my grandmother loved the Lord and walked through those churches boldly and activated her love to make sure something showed up differently. That's what I mean when I say love. So yes, I hug you because I love you, but I'm talking about how you put love in action so that you actually produce justice. That's the love I'm talking about.
That's great. All right. So last question, what brings you hope?
I think I'm always, I am always hopeful for these are the things that bring me hope. One is when people can set aside their mask and their armor, because lots of people live with that, particularly Black men, right? Because of the environments that we've constructed, they have to live with armor. When they can set that aside and show joy, that gives me hope, because that's my ambition, is like, how do we create a space where everybody has that ability to enjoy life? Enjoy their humanity without feeling like you have to protect yourself. And those, that's not just the feeling, it's a reality. They do have to protect themselves in so many ways. And it's not just men, it's women, it's all of us, right? And it's not just Black or white or native or whatever. It's all of us. How do we put down that armor? And when I see people do that, that gives me deep hope. And then, of course, young people, particularly my daughter, my youngest daughter gives me a ton of hope because she's so passionate about the things that she's passionate about. And she takes me on every topic or issue. And I go back and forth with her. And what I love is like when she doesn't give up, because like I need her, the world needs her to have a backbone that actually is going to allow her to transform the world. And that when I see that in young people, I'm always hopeful because they're the reason I'm in Minneapolis, and they're the reason that we're actually the adults we are. And it's going to be their turn next.
Yeah. Tanya Allen, McKnight Foundation CEO, you are a leader for good. I think you're doing your grandma proud.
Oh,
and we're so grateful for your time today. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders, helping to inspire you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. You bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Crimes Of is a weekly series that explores a new theme each season, starting with the true crimes that inspired Hollywood's most iconic horror villains.
Listen to and follow Crimes Of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Radio Rental. The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life, all told by real people. And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. There's something here in this house, something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.